What you've been listening to is the Grand Tonometer, 616 tuning forks that are located at the National Museum of American History. Richard Chartier, a Smithsonian Artist Research Fellow and sound and installation artist, discovered these when he met with curator Stephen Turner, curator of physical sciences. So how did you both start working together?
Originally, I had been asked by Lynn Myers, another visual artist who was a Smithsonian Artist Research Fellow last year, to come and join her on a tour of the collection of physical science collection, scientific instrument collection, and meet with Stephen. And so we came down and saw all these amazing instruments that were used for the kind of the visualization or explanation of sound and the physical nature of acoustics. And we were walking around, and one item was even more amazing than the next. And then we finally got to this one item. He opened this big cabinet, and there is the Grand Tonometer, which is the collection of 660 tuning forks, which range 4 octaves, I believe. And it was just absolutely amazing to see. And first thing I thought was, I have to do something with this. I have to somehow record this. And I asked Stephen, how many of these are there in the world? He goes, that's it. That's the one. And so here was this amazingly unique object from 1870 to 1875 that was in the back, in storage. And I really wanted to do a project with it. And so I worked with him to figure out what that could be. And I came up with recording every single one of these tuning forks and other instruments by Rudolf Koenig.
Stephen, can you talk a little bit more about the tonometer?
Of course. The tonometer is one of a group of instruments that were made by a French instrument maker, Rudolf Koenig, who worked in a quiet area of Paris in the second half of the 19th century. And Koenig was probably the greatest acoustic instrument maker to have ever lived, and also an important scientist in his own right. And he would create these instruments to pursue his own research and to engage the scientists of his time. The tonometer is remarkable, as Richard said. It's essentially covers 4 octaves at 4 and 8 wavelength intervals between the forks, and each tuning fork was handmade by Koenig in his home, which was also his shop. He had a special laboratory in the top floor of his house where he would test these tuning forks and file them down until they were absolutely perfect, and they're the most precise tuning forks ever made. And it's I was really looking forward to Richard's reaction to seeing such a representation of 19th century science.
So, Richard, as an artist, what fascinated you about the tonometer?
What fascinated me about the tonometer was not only that it was the only one in the world, but that it was a device that was used to create, the perfect pitch, these sine waves. When what I do normally in the past 10 years, and I'm sorry, since 1998, was using a computer to digitally create sine waves and waveforms, and really starting off with a basic sine wave as the building block for everything I created. So everything was created inside the computer. There was nothing external about it. And the idea of working with the tonometer and the physicality of it, this was the representation of, in the physical world, of what I've been creating digitally. Uh-huh. So I like that idea. Most recently, I did a recording called Fields for Mixing, and it was a collection of field recordings that I had done over the years and created into a long piece. And so I was getting interested again in trying to explore the physical nature of what I was doing rather than purely digital. Mm-hmm. And so when I was recording these 660 tuning forks, which is a lot of tuning forks to record individually, and a lot of, second takes and third takes, I was trying to get them very, very perfect. But then I was thinking, well, that's me trying to recreate something that I would do digitally. And then I realized, why don't I just record what I can and get the best sounding one, but then keep in the flaws, or you know what I would consider flaws in a digital file. Mm-hmm. And so it gave a very natural feel to it, a humanist feel to the recordings, and I think it changed the way I work. I was actually interested in these flaws.
Mm-hmm. And when you work with these artifacts all the time, Stephen, how does working with an artist and hearing an artist's point of view about them, has it changed the way you think about them or impact how you think about them?
Richard and I joked about this as he was working on these, because the instruments in our collection, the physical sciences collection, they used to be called philosophical instruments, and they were created to lead you to a certain kind of understanding about the physical world, a rational exploration of in this case sound and how it was produced, how it interacted with other sounds, and a little bit about how it was experienced, but really more the physical nature of sound. But Richard's approach was completely different. He was starting with the idea of the experience and then manipulating it from there. So I would find myself, as I was showing him other instruments in the collection, I would be trying to direct his attention towards one particular phenomenon that the instrument was designed to produce. And he was inevitably looking at the wrong end of the instrument and asking some question that I had never even considered. So it was a challenging in a good way, and in a certain way, a liberating way of looking at these instruments, because it was so completely different from what I had done before.
Your background is as a scientist, is that right?
I'm a historian, and my degree is in philosophy.
Oh, in philosophy, okay. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you end up working with these collections in a way.
It's almost perfect for me. As I said, they were originally, prior to about 1850, they were called philosophical instruments, and the generally men who made them were called philosophical instrument makers. And that's really the way that I see them, I suppose, in the most fundamental sense, is philosophical lessons and this deeper understanding of the natural world.
What I found interesting when we were working together is Stephen talked about how these would be presented to people, like all these different, not just the grand tonometer, but other instruments would be shown in what was considered sound seances. And I loved the idea of a sound seance where you're almost like pulling these things from the ether, you know, and they're communicating with you somehow. So while I was doing these recordings of other instruments, I was thinking about that, because there's all this history to these instruments, and then they're kind of, you know, put away, and it's almost like not revisiting them, but re-communicating with them.
Oh, cool.
Communing, I guess you could say.
Based on the experience of working together, how do you, you know, what has it, you were talking about you're going to be working on a new piece, how has it impacted the way that you think about what you do with sound and installation?
I think for the piece that will premiere on October 7th at the Hirshhorn, mm-hmm. in the auditorium, the structure, I'm still thinking structurally the same when I'm creating a work, but I think the physical nature of the sounds and how, you know, when I process them, there's still a very natural feeling to them. There's a very natural resonance. It's not artificial. It's not digital. Mm-hmm. So I think there's kind of a warmth to it, mm-hmm. in a way that I think may not be present in a lot of my other works that are purely digital. Mm-hmm. So the same kind of structures, but working with a completely different set, basically a different set of instruments.
Great. And Stephen, what about you? You were saying that something might have come out of this experience as well, in terms of
very much so. I mean, Richard is the first artist in residence that we've had in this collection, and so my colleagues were very much interested in how this experience would go and what would come out of it. And we've benefited from the attention that our collection has gotten, and particularly the attention that the Grand Tonometer has gotten. It looks like we're going to be putting a web project up and possibly exhibiting it with some concert and together with some concerts or other musical events. So we're just starting to have that conversation, but I think we're going to get some programming visibility out of this, which is always welcome.
Okay. An interesting thing that I like to think about is that artists are also involved with research, and they're also involved with testing their own hypothesis, just like a scientist. And I wonder if, as someone who works with a curator of physical sciences, is there something that you can take from an artist's process and apply it to what you do?
One of the things that I try to include in my work and to bring forward to my colleagues is the fact that these instruments were made to be used to produce specific effects, and that you can't really understand them without using them, without producing these effects, and talking about the ways that these effects were then understood by the people of the time. Richard, as you know, a modern viewer, a modern consumer of these effects, has a completely different point of view. And this sort of, for me, it increases the historiosity of the instruments. To compare them, I can go back in books and see how these instruments were understood, but then to see an informed modern observer reacting in a different way is, as I said before, it's somewhat liberating for me or empowering in the kinds of research that I do.
And Richard, is there anything that you would take away from working with someone who works more with artifacts and thinks of it in more historical terms?
Well, just the opportunity to be able to come towards go towards an instrument and not go at it just as a, you know, oh, that's a beautiful thing, or I could use that somehow. It's really putting the element of history into it. And mm-hmm. I think that all of Stephen's knowledge gave me a greater understanding of what exactly the place of these instruments was, mm-hmm. and still is.
And it seems like the parts that you got from it also had sparked some of your ideas in ways like this seance.
Yeah, exactly. Like
that.
Well, it to me, it was kind of this kismet thing where it all fit together. Like, this was the perfect instrument for me to be dealing with. Mm-hmm. Two of the other major goals of this, the Artist Research Fellowship, was to record all these things. So there would be a recording of the Grand Tonometer, because no one had ever done that. So mm-hmm. these will, once I finally finish editing these, which is still a while away, because just it's a long and arduous process, and I intend to have these donated as a sound archive, a 24-bit sound archive, to the Smithsonian for their use, and then also to work with Stephen again somehow to present an installation which incorporates the recordings, an interactive piece, so people can kind of activate the tonometer, mm-hmm. for example, without touching it. So,
oh, cool.
It just seems like I keep thinking of more things, because it was just so inspiring to be able to work with not only the tonometer and Stephen, but all these other devices and things in storage, and my curiosity is very piqued.
Oh, great. Well, thank you both for talking to us about this, and I appreciate it.